Well, before we start talking about Blue Calhoun and some other things, we ought to probably get a medical update on you. How have you been?
Medical alert. I've been fine. I have an annual scan of my spine and the site of the tumor, and it's been clear for the past 8 years. So I'm feeling good about that.
Well, you look healthy and chipper, and that's something good. And mentally, I guess, with all of the work you're doing, you're still turning all the stuff out, huh?
Seems to be continuing to come, yeah. So that's a big satisfaction.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Blue Calhoun and how this book came about. What gave you the inspiration for this novel?
Well, I think the real inspiration probably goes very far back in my childhood when I was a close little watcher of my very large extended family in northeastern North Carolina. And when I began to realize that several of my male cousins had or were in the process of having erotic adventures with women who were not their wives. And it deeply fascinated me. I was a pre-adolescent child because I had seen such things sort of suggested in movies, the movies of the 30s and 40s. But when they began to happen a little closer by, and I'm definitely not talking about my intimate family, but my extended family, I think I really began to feel the mystery of passion. I mean, why people do these apparently totally illogical, kind of discontinuous acts of simply suddenly meeting a 16-year-old young woman as Blue does on a particular April day and simply throwing the whole course of his life in her direction. And the course of his life involves a wife and a daughter and a great many other things and people. So I think children in general are fascinated by passion because they are such passionate little creatures. So I think it's probably a big theme of all my work, but it's certainly the central motor theme of Blue Calhoun, just that kind of physical, spiritual passion.
Blue Calhoun, of course, his real name is Bluford, which is... I guess that must be a typically Southern name, huh?
Bluford is a Southern name, yeah. And it, in fact, repeats a common Southern pattern, which is that a man or a woman is frequently given one of the family surnames, last names, as a first name. In my own case, Reynolds was the family name of one of my great grandmothers, Miss Martha Reynolds. So Bluford is presumably one of his family surnames. It's been given him as a first name.
Now, in spite of Blue's indiscretion with the girl named Luna, everybody in the book seems incredibly decent. Blue's wife, for example, even takes him back. And his daughter puts, Blue's daughter, a young daughter, is about the same age as Luna puts up with him. And his mother sometimes is angry with him and takes him in and then says, no, you can't come around. But everybody seems quite civilized. It would seem to me that in some instances, this would cause a rupture that would be irrevocable. But that doesn't happen in Blue's life, does it?
Well, in some instances, obviously it would, especially in a culture like ours now, in which 50% of marriages, or even a little bit more, maybe end in divorce. Blue's big adventure, Blue's great erotic adventure, occurs in 1956-57. And in the America of those days, and certainly in the South of those days, divorce was an extremely rare phenomenon. So was separation, permanent separation. In none of the cases in my own family in which there were those kinds of adventures did any wife ever actually leave a husband. They waited until the husband returned.
I'm gonna wait for a second. So much for my countermanding the phone.
Yeah, we were talking about how sometimes impossible it was to accept a divorce in that period.
Yeah, I thought about it recently when someone else said to me, well, surely all these women would not have put up with this. I realized that I was born in 1933. I was in my 20s before I ever actually met a divorced person. I had heard of them. And I didn't live in any kind of especially sheltered family, nor in a Roman Catholic family. And by the way, Blue's wife and daughter are devout Roman Catholics, which is further reason for their great forbearance in the face of his behavior. But I think, you know, even today, with the divorce rate being what it is, virtually any one of us could name marital unions which have survived some pretty terrific adventures. Our forthcoming, apparently, Democratic candidate for president seems to be rather cryptically telling us that his has survived such a battering.
Now, there's another theme that runs all the way through the book, and that's the theme of incest. I never even knew such a thing as incest. I mean, I'd heard of it, but until recently, it seems that everybody's talking about incest. Now we can talk about it, but tell me a little bit about this element of the book.
Well, I agree. Incest does seem to be the crime of the moment. Again, I suppose, until perhaps the last 10 years or so of my life, I was very unfamiliar with it outside of, say, Greek tragedy or certain kinds of novels. Every now and then, I remember as a child, I would see in the local paper that that so-and-so had been arrested in connection with what was called carnal knowledge of a minor child somewhere in a North Carolina town. It was generally an uncle or a father. And I remember once asking my father what that meant, and he told me. Yeah, I think it's become one of the most amazing and one of the most awful revelations that we've had in recent years. I think the figure now says that something like one in four or five American women has experienced incest in childhood, and that perhaps one in 10 men has. So, Lord, that's something else we've got to master. And I don't think it turned up in my writing of Boo Calhoun simply because it's on the Donahue and Oprah shows once a week, but I think it really turned up because I felt that in the particular situation which Blue flings at his family, his wife and daughter, and at Luna, the young woman with whom he's infatuated, he discovers that this kind of physical sexual havoc has been wreaked on their lives. And because he's pretty convinced that he himself has wreaked many different kinds of havoc on his family and on Luna, I think he absorbs a lot of the guilt for these instances of incest, though he himself is on that particular score. Blue is entirely innocent. It's one of the few scores on which he is entirely innocent.
But things seem to come full circle. Incest doesn't stop with Luna, but it appears at the end of the book, yeah, in a very tragic ending, as well as the breast cancer. I mean, that comes up again, too. It seems as though in the novel, history continues to repeat itself.
Well, it does, and I don't think that's because I have some kind of fateful theory of human existence or of natural life. I think it's because we know. We now know that if a woman's mother had breast cancer, her genetic chances of developing cancer are pretty awful. We do know that physical child abuse and incest do seem to be regenerating through generations in families. If a particular parent has been violated in childhood, that parent apparently is prone, at least, toward committing that offense in his or her own life. So I think it's part of Blue's own eventual sense when the novel comes on down into the late 1980s and he's a much older man. I think it's his part of what he feels he needs to make reparations for. Not that he feels that he has sexually violated the two women in question, but that he really feels that that his particular kind of waste and havoc in his relations with them is just horribly epitomized by their having been incested, and that he needs to make every kind of amends he can make, both to Luna and to the nameless other person whom you and I are avoided revealing to the reader who has suffered in that way.
Well, Blue, of course, makes these revelations in a letter to his granddaughter, a very, very long letter. And I suppose, in a way, you've already answered the question I was about to ask, why he would reveal himself in that way. But I guess it's a way of seeking atonement. Is that true?
I think it's a way of seeking atonement for himself, and I think it's primarily Even more primarily, I think it's a way of trying to help his granddaughter understand the traumas in which she has found herself, and trying to make her see the whole, what he thinks of as the whole family history, to see it in a fuller perspective than simply the kind of obsession with personal pain that most of us have when we're plunged into a trauma, especially if we're the age of his granddaughter, which is in her teens. So I think, you had said that decency somehow prevails in the characters' lives, and I think it does for all the wasteful things that they do to one another, and Blue is the prime doer. I think the ultimate hope of the book and the ultimate hope of Blue in writing this very long journal letter, which he's been writing for his granddaughter over a period of weeks, the major intent is mercy. As many of us have experienced in our own lives, if we've managed to live, on into our 40s or 50s, I'm in my late 50s now, I've witnessed, thank God, in my life, a number of instances in which people were certainly not able to eradicate the harm that they had done or the memory of it, but were able to ask for pardon and to receive it pretty genuinely, I think.
Well, that's all you can do. You can't change the past. You have to go on. I think we've all made mistakes in our lives, but it'd be murder if we had to live out these mistakes every day, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I think one of the amazing things, even just from consuming popular culture on daily television, we see the number of people, the parents of a murdered child, the grown women who have survived parental incest, the grown men, whatever. I think we see the enormously toxic effect that those outrages, the enormous toxic effect that the continuance of those outrages in their lives has wreaked on them. It's seldom noted any longer that virtually all the major religions of the earth recommend forgiveness as the only conceivable way of proceeding onward through a sane life of any duration. We're a country which claims to be highly religious, and yet if we listen to television or listen to the events that surround a death penalty crisis, we hear the constant ancient cry for vengeance and blood and vendetta.
Yeah, we really have it in this country. The homicide rate that we have is the highest of any industrialized democracy. We have more people in prison. We are executing people. I don't think any other civilized country executes its people. There's a tenor or a level of violence in this country that it's frightening. And it seems, isn't it your perception that it's gotten worse?
It's my perception that it's gotten worse. And it's my certainty that certainly in many places, especially particular geographic areas of certain cities, it's gotten a great deal worse. I used to come to New York when I was a high school boy. I would come up alone on the Seaboard Railroad and stay at the old Taft Hotel and wander all over the place, any hour of the day or night, Times Square, subways up into farthest Harlem, and never for a moment felt any trace of fear, never in all those times ever had an unpleasant encounter of any sort. I'd be dead fairly shortly if I attempted that many times now. I also think that if we look back really at early American history, right on back into the 17th and 18th centuries, we find that we do seem to have been this especially violent branch, that is, those of us who can consider ourselves white Westerners, we seem to have been an especially violent brand of Homo sapiens. And I don't see any signs of the diminution of that.
No, I was talking to Edward de Grazia, the great civil liberties lawyer. He's written a new book about censorship and obscenity. And he said there is a feeling of respect for violence in this country that, say, sex doesn't have. We don't respect sex so much because people have tried to censor it and outlaw it and restrict it and control it and so forth. But violence, well, you can turn on television and watch movies, and it can be depicted in comics and in books, and very seldom does anybody speak out against violence.
Yeah.
It's a way of life. And that's really scary, that it should be, if anything, just shouldn't the condemnation be reversed? You know, you should support sex and condemn violence?
Sounds like a healthier program to me, with certain limitations for sanitation and self-protection and the protection of others. No one is at all surprised in America when a man executes an act of vengeance that results in the death or the severe damage to another human being. That is simply assumed to be, you know, the law of retaliation, an eye for an eye. We have numerous fundamentalist religious who even defend it on biblical grounds. What surprises me more is not the frequency with which men execute actual vengeance. What surprises me most often in watching, as I seem to be saying here, television talk about this sort of thing, is how very frequently the women involved in such situations, the mother of the murdered child, the mother of whatever, they seem so frequently to be these obsessed invokers of vengeance. You know, although the mother who will be interviewed the night before the alleged murderer of her child is to be electrocuted, the mother will simply be saying, nothing will satisfy but the bloody death of this offender. And that strikes me as being absolutely terrifying and absolutely counter to all the religious creeds to which a majority of Americans say they adhere.
Well, I have to say, though, I don't mean to be insulting about that, but it seems to me that the bulk of the violence, and certainly the bulk of the official executions, take place in your native South.
I suppose you're right, Don. But that provides me with no surprise whatsoever. The majority of the murders are in the Northeast, or in the very large urban areas. But I don't know. The South does seem to put people to death at a more rapid rate. I'm not prepared to try to draw you a sociological observation from that.
And it doesn't stem the crime either, does it? It
doesn't stem the crime in the least, no. If anything, I suspect, simply ups the ante and makes crime that much more exciting and dangerous to the kinds of very frenzy-addicted people who seem to indulge in a great many of our murders.
Well, let's go on to a slightly happier topic, and that is the language in the Blue Calhoun. It's very, very distinctive, and obviously very, very southern. And the people all speak in, sometimes in cliches, but in ways that are extremely colorful, as opposed to the kind of newer Midwestern type of language that I had. So tell me a little bit about the southern language that you have so well inserted in the book.
Well, it's not, as I'm sure you know, it's not southern in any sort of stereotypical barn dance, hee-haw way. It's southern in the sense of sort of rich and sensuous and closely tied always to what I think of as a very sensuous appreciation of visible nature, the way things look, smell, feel, taste. Not that Blue spends a lot of time describing things, he doesn't, but I think it's his natural gift to be able to evoke sensual impressions, sensory impressions for a reader. Everyone in the book, after all, is presented entirely through Blue's hand, because he's the person writing the letter which tells the story. So if we say that all the people talk a bit alike, that's simply because they're being fed to us through a single mind, which is Blue's. I think the characters in the book are very diverse, and I didn't have any qualms whatever about letting them all be fed to us through Blue, because the way he describes them to us also tells us a great deal about who he is and how he perceives the world. The South, I guess. The South, both in its Anglo-Saxon and Celtic strains and its African-American strains, has simply produced the richest brand of language, especially the two big races which have composed the South, white and black, have formed together indissolubly this very rich language, which continues, I think, to distinguish Southern letters from anything else that goes on in America, and to distinguish them in the very richness with which I think they tried to convey the sensory world to us. Toni Morrison, who's a writer of enormous distinction. Toni was born and raised in Lorain, Ohio, but her parents are from Georgia. And I think the sensory richness that's revealed in Toni's novels, most recently in Jazz, is again very much a direct result of that particular kind of biracial eloquence of the South.
I do believe that that there is a richness in the language in the South that is not duplicated anyplace else, and it's not really clear. You mentioned the Celtic and Anglo-Saxon background, but you find that same background in the Midwest, where I'm from, and yet the people don't seem to have a sense of language or a lilt to their voices. Remember the old, the way Harry Truman talked, for example, or Elmer Davis in the news. And these are relatively harsh-sounding words without a particular degree of color in them. But South is rich both in the, not only in its eloquence, but in the lilt tongue. I mean, it's, and it almost, in some respects, sometimes sounds English. Have you noticed that?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah. So there is a, I don't know, you've come to New York a lot over the years, but don't you find the New York voices grating, difficult to accept?
I find them often very fascinating and often very rich in their own kind of comedy and eloquence, but certainly the amount of abrasion that's implicit in a great many Manhattan or five boroughs in social interchanges, it does seem to me, you know, the epitome of abrasion. A Southern violent encounter is likely to begin and end within a matter of 10 seconds. You would, like a Sicilian or extremely passionate Latin, violent outburst of temper and violent solution to the problem then and there, you would almost never hear, as one hears frequently in New York, the kind of street corner harangue between two drivers who've bumped into one another or you know, whatever. Especially the major urban Northeast does seem to specialize in that kind of violent harangue on the edge of violence that so frequently doesn't actually burst into violence. Whereas in the South, you can be having a perfectly happy conversation with someone who may suddenly whip out a knife and disembowel you. I mean, not that it happens terribly frequently. No one should cancel his or her vacation plans to visit Atlanta or wherever. But it is a much more hot-headed and more suddenly resolved kind of abrasion. I have absolutely no suggestion as to where Southern language comes from, other than the reasons I've given, which, as you say, almost all of which prevail or have prevailed historically in other parts of the country, except one, which is the ongoing, intimate in every sense of the word, conversation that has been conducted for over 300 years between two very different but totally bound together by fate, races of people, and that is basically Anglo-whites and African-Americans who were brought here under protest, to say the least.
Do you always have a project that you're working on, literary project?
Well, I have for the last 8 or 9 years. There have been brief times earlier in my career in which I sort of was taking a rest between books, though I've never had a time that I remember as having been anything that I thought of as writer's block. I've never remembered having a fallow period in which I was worried as to whether I would ever write again. And certainly since I had this spinal cancer 8 years ago and have been physically a bit more limited in my movements, I've had perhaps more time to sit still and think about things that I wanted to do and things that I wanted to do next. So, yeah, I'm finishing up now a big volume of collected short stories, which will gather up all the stories that I have published earlier and about 350 pages of new stories. And then beyond that, I'm hoping to write a play, which I've begun but haven't finished, and more fiction and memoir. I don't have them sort of neatly laid out on outlines or on a calendar, but they're sort of things that float around my head like sort of benign balloons, sort of waiting to be reached for and pulled down and anchored.
How do you structure your day?
I structure my day the way the average 8-hour worker does. I get up in the morning and get dressed and eat breakfast and get to the office, which happens to be a room in my house, a corner of my own apartment in my house, and I sit down at the word processor by 9 in the morning, and I work with time off for phone calls and cups of coffee and so forth. I work until 12:30, when I have an extremely light lunch, and then I take a little rest and get up and start working again, 2:30 or so in the afternoon, and work through until supper time, which is usually around 6:30 or 7. Then I probably will take the evening off. But I may, if I'm especially very excited about something, or getting very near the end of a book, which is always the most exciting part, I may well do some more work after dinner in the evening. But more often I'd be seeing friends or going out somewhere or watching a videotape or something like that in the evening, just sort of basically zoning out. Resting.
You're still teaching, aren't you?
Teach one semester a year, still at Duke University. And I've just finished doing that. I teach two courses, one in Milton's poetry and some sort of course in writing every year. And so I spend from January through April doing that every year, which I still love a lot.
And for assistance, since you're still wheelchair bound, you have, I believe, you have a student that assists you over a period of the year, is that correct?
I've had a series of seven. Former students, each had graduated by the time he came to work for me, and each has stayed at least 12 months. I've been tremendously lucky to have these live-in helpers who do various physical chores for me that I can't accomplish or can't accomplish safely or with ease. So have my long life in Duke University has rewarded me in more ways than one.
They're kind of like Supreme Court law clerks. Huh? Are they literary students, and do they benefit from any of your guidance?
Almost all of them have been students who were interested in writing, whether or not as a potential career, writing or music, strangely enough. I haven't really planned to try to have musicians and or writers, but it's tended to work out that way. So I think it provides them a further reward in the year's work that they get to hang out in the midst of the life of a professional writer who also has a number of friends who are involved in the arts in one way or another.
I'm surprised. It was great to see you again, and Blue Calhoun is a beautifully written book. It's certainly not unexpected. I look forward to seeing your collected short stories when they come out, and hope that we'll have a chance to talk again at that time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don, as always.